Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This year, we've partnered with Common Bond, a company that helps medical students save money on their student loans by customizing a loan for current medical students with rates that beat the federal Grad Plus loan. Forget everything you knew about private loans. Common Bond is the new way to pay for medical school. ITB listeners also get a $300 bonus when they sign up. Get started today at commonbond.co/ITB. That's commonbond.co/ITB.
Thank you, India. Thank you, terror. Thank you, this illusion man. Thank you, frailty.
Welcome to the Inside the Boards podcast, the podcast dedicated to helping you learn to think like a question writer so you can study smarter, not harder, and succeed in medical school. And now here's your host, Patrick Beeman.
All right, welcome to part two of our pulmonary review. Without any delay, let's get right into the main aspect of today's show.
So, okay, what factor could have caused this shift in the oxygen-hemoglobin dissociation curve? So we have a 43-year-old woman who presents to the emergency department with cherry red skin and dizziness. She says that she had a sudden headache. On exam, she has a pulse ox of 100%, but her O2 saturation is decreased. Again, which factors could have caused this shift in the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve? Is it A, increase in temperature? B, carbon monoxide poisoning? C, decreased 2-3 BPG? Or D, decrease in pH? So, I know you know the answer to this by sheer, just this, the presentation. So, but go ahead and walk me through it.
So, there's a couple things to this question. One, I do think it's a little funny that we keep talking about cherry red skin for this, and that is actually an autopsy finding.
Yeah, exactly. she wouldn't walk in.
Cherry red, and if she's cherry red, you missed it quite a while ago. Probably a more typical presentation of this would be you get a entire family checks into the emergency department, all saying that they've got headache, dizziness, and myalgias after spending a night in a cold, poorly heated house. But you're looking for some reason that would shift an oxygen dissociation curve while at the same time keeping a pulse ox at 100%. So pulse ox is a colorimetric test that it's imperfect, especially there are newer pulse oximetry devices, but the standard ones are fooled by any sort of saturated hemoglobin. So it really, it's almost like instead of an O2 sat, it's more of a hemoglobin sat. The machine will read 100% regardless of the molecule that's attached. And so carbon monoxide, being something that has such a high affinity for hemoglobin, will actually show up as 100%. So we'll go through all the other ones, but the answer being carbon monoxide poisoning, the reason that it shows up as a 100% on pulse ox is because the machine is tricked by it.
Right. And you have that carbon monoxide binding the hemoglobin and causing a similar, I guess, frequency of colorimetric to be emitted. So it doesn't register as any different to the machines. At least the older ones, or maybe new ones are a little better. Maybe
there are, so there's two ways you can test for carbon monoxide. You can use a device called a co-oximetry. That's a similar type of just little finger probe that is colorimetric, but it's better and it can tell the difference between the different forms of hemoglobin. And that's pretty accurate. So you can do that without even drawing blood. And then you could just, you could send off a blood gas is the other way to do it. So just knowing that there are other ways that we check to make sure that it is actually carbon monoxide.
So for this, there are a couple other things here. There is so it causes a shift in the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve. I really didn't think it did that so much as decreased the total curve, but it, I guess that is a shift. But I think of the total binding capacity for, you know, O2 to kind of drop because it's being competed against this carbon monoxide, taking up space on the hemoglobin. So there's less oxygen being delivered to the tissues. Like you said, you know, you can kind of diagnose or answer this question just on the vignette alone. Mindful of the autopsy finding a cherry red skin, we can still go with the dizziness and headache, and knowing that she's got this O2 sat that says 100%, but the overall saturation's actually decreased. So just knowing those things, you can probably lend yourself to the actual diagnosis of carbon monoxide poisoning. However, there are some important, like, there are changes to the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve that occurs with changes in temperature, pH, and the 2,3 BPG as well. I have kind of a very fast and loose understanding or way of learning this, so I will try to teach everyone really quickly because it saved me from like really having to dig this in and figure it out for each and every one of them. But for most things, if you change pH there to the concentration of hydrogen ions, which is the ergo of what pH stands for, right? Then you can essentially use increase and decrease to determine which way the curve is going to shift. So anything that increases, if you take the increase, that's going to cause a right shift in most of those things. And if it decreases, it's going to cause a left shift in most of those things. If you look in first aid, again, change pH and then all of the different variables will cause that same pattern, and it makes it just a lot easier to memorize. So I recommend doing that. Obviously, we're on an audio podcast and you can't visualize this, so it may be something to think about next time you're looking at that chart. But that was basically how I remembered it for step one, and it served me. So hopefully it helps you too.
Yeah, it's definitely something, the chart especially, and you can find that in basically any review book, is super helpful. It's a high yield topic. There's going to be probably a couple questions on the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve. I remembered it the same way. So if you take pH as a, you know, a decrease in pH as an increase in hydrogen ions, then you can say an increase in any of the factors shifts the curve to the right, and then any decrease shifts the curve to the left. A couple other things. So I think everyone says the 2,3 BPG. I don't think people have a good understanding of what that actually is.
Yeah, I remember. You know,
but it's kind of interesting to learn about it. It's a glycolysis byproduct.
Exactly. That's all I remember. Yeah. Is there was this little, there was probably like two slides when you learned about glycolysis where it was like, there's this shunt for this 2,3 BPG and it goes to hemoglobin and makes it bind or shifts the curve. Right. Okay.
and then you forget about it. And then it is kind of neat to know that it's a, one of the ways that your body adapts to varying concentrations of oxygen in your environment. So as you say, you go to high altitudes, it's one of your adaptations to a high altitude is to increase your amount of BPG, which actually decreases affinity for oxygen to hemoglobin. So it's more likely to dump oxygen into the tissues, which is really what you need at those high altitudes. So just a little bit more about carbon monoxide, I think, is a really fascinating subject. Diagnosing it really can be quite difficult in reality, because it frequently shows up in winter months. It's right around flu season, and all the symptoms basically sound like the flu. So it's always something to have in the back of your mind if you see a question that talks about either an entire family that's sick, or people who have symptoms that sound like a viral syndrome but don't have a fever. And they may give you some explanation as to the patient is using a kerosene heater or something, because carbon monoxide being a byproduct of incomplete carbon combustion, there's usually some sort of heater and poorly ventilated room involved. The treatment is 100% oxygen, and that is frequently tested just because it's such an easy thing, and it makes so much sense physiologically. If you're having a molecule that's competing for your hemoglobin, you just kind of got to force it out with increased partial pressure of oxygen. So you just throw a non-rebreather at 100% on the patient, and that decreases the half-life of the carbon monoxide hemoglobin association. The other answer you may see pop up for treatment of this is hyperbarics. So again, it's just an 100% oxygen and an increased partial pressure. More atmospheres of pure oxygen will reduce the time that the carbon monoxide is attached to the hemoglobin, and theoretically can reduce the long-term consequences. Get a lot of neurologic problems from prolonged exposure to carbon monoxide.
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting conspiracy on Reddit about this this illustrious post where someone had like some paranoia symptoms and it worked out to be carbon monoxide or something. Google it if you have the time.
Nice. it's a very tough thing to diagnose. I've seen it a couple times, and it's really subtle.
Yeah, and they won't make that for them. They won't make it that difficult for this test, at least. And you're right. The reality is not the test, unless they give you cherry red skin. Yeah. Then you're like, oh,
that's not quite right. But do you know? Yeah. I mean, knowing that 100% oxygen or hyperbarics would be the treatment of choice.
Exactly, and they may do that kind of like a competitive inhibitor question, and they could easily be a kinetics question. The other thing I think about is, like, I guess if you really were in a real desperate situation, you could give them blood and just offset the carbon monoxide, but you'd have to be really desperate at that point.
Yeah. They occasionally will ask stuff about what the PaO2 and the hemoglobin, what would it actually look like if you had a carbon monoxide poisoning? And the answer is they look normal. Because their hemoglobin is the same, and their actual partial pressure of dissolved oxygen is the same in the plasma. So, the hemoglobin's not the problem. It's that association.
All right, let's do this next one here. So, which of the following drugs most likely resulted in this side effect? We have a 28-year-old female who comes to your clinic to receive a PPD test so that she can start working in a hospital setting. 4 days later, she returns with a positive PPD test, and you confirm that she has tuberculosis with a chest x-ray. After prescribing her a few first-line treatment drugs for tuberculosis, she is sent home. A few weeks later, the patient comes back complaining that she has been urinating a red/orange color. Again, which of the following drugs most likely resulted in this side effect? Is it A, ethambutol, B, pyrazinamide, C, isoniazid, or D, rifampin? I feel bad for this patient who came back 4 days later with a positive PPD.
Right.
They should
have. And someone probably should have warned her about the color change in her urine.
Yeah, exactly. This didn't go right. So how would you work through this? I think it's pretty straightforward. You think, okay, what drug?
Yeah, and this is one of those questions where the whole vignette is not as important. You don't really need to know why she was getting treated. It's just looking for a side effect. I do find it interesting. It does sound like this is probably latent TB from what I can see on the question stem, but I won't nitpick on that. You've got your ripe therapy for what we're presuming is active tuberculosis. That's your four drugs for 2 months, two drugs for 4 months kind of therapy, which is still, it's still pretty much first line therapy for an active case of tuberculosis. And they love these medication side effect questions because these are all very interesting drugs that you don't see in a lot of other places. So it's kind of the one time that the board writers get to actually grill you on this stuff. Each of the four drugs has a pretty characteristic side effect that you need to know. And so if you only know one, that's usually enough. So ethambutol is the one that has a retinal damage. So basically causes almost a acquired colorblindness. So you can just remember that ethambutol is the eye stuff, E for eye.
E for eye, yep.
Pyrazinamide is probably the least interesting of the drugs in terms of their side effects. It's just the one I remember is hepatotoxicity. Isoniazid, I find this incredibly fascinating, mostly because of the fellowship I'm going into, but isoniazid actually can cause seizures and peripheral nerve palsies because of its depletion of B6. So that gets into some fun biochemistry if you really want to go down the rabbit hole. It's a drug that is, unfortunately, especially in like developing countries where active TB is more common, is a drug that people will take an overdose. And so the outcome of that is seizure. And the treatment for that is B6. So kind of an interesting factoid about isoniazid. But they will, usually for someone who's taking therapeutic doses of isoniazid, a peripheral nerve palsy, like a wrist drop or something like that, is certainly possible. And the way to prevent that is to supplement B6. So at least rifampin, the red-orange color, R for red, pretty easy to remember, and it's not really any detrimental effect. It does throw off like urine tests and stuff like that, but rifampin red urine is a common association.
And if you don't tell them, they will come back and they'll be like, "I'm peeing blood now. Yeah, what's wrong?" Right.
And the same thing for so you get the same. So red urine is something you also see with peridium, which is a bladder analgesic, and also with interestingly the antidote for cyanide, hydroxycobalamin, can also cause red urine. So those are the three drugs I think of for a red orange urine.
Did not know that about hydroxycobalamin. Though you point out a good point about these, of course. These are pretty straightforward in terms of what they can cause. So they do like to test them. You give away two with just like the first letter.
Right.
So the eyes with ethambutol, the red urine for rifampin. You mentioned that pyrazinamide is essentially, they don't talk about anything with it. Maybe hepatotoxicity comes up, but I don't even think I ever got a question on that.
No, it's not as interesting, so it doesn't get tested as much.
Yeah, so and then isoniazid, they love the peripheral neuropathy and B6 thing. So keeping that in mind as well that's pretty much the important stuff for those. Let's see. I guess isoniazid is another important one for drug-induced lupus. So that might be something, that might be a way they could go down. Instead, they come back and now they have a positive ANA. Yeah, you might be concerned that they're now like starting to have lupus after their tuberculosis. But
I just assume every drug can cause drug-induced lupus.
Yeah, exactly. If you have a male with lupus particularly, yeah. I'm thinking you have a drug. Okay. I think that's pretty thorough there. We can get into the fact that this question probably wouldn't need to use all four of these drugs.
Probably just needs a couple months of...
Rifampin would be fine, assuming this is a latent TB.
All right, that concludes part two of our pulmonary review. We still have a couple episodes we need to upload for the Study Smarter series. I know a lot of you have already taken USMLE Step 1, but you know, life, as many of you have heard me say, I am still a full-time OBGYN, and the other team members inside the boards, a lot of them are either full-time clinicians or medical students, so as you can imagine, the stars can align where the time and availability of all of us to contribute to the podcast, work on our app, our audio key bank, and et cetera, can be limited. So, you know, we're working hard for you. We appreciate you leaving a review of our shows on Apple Podcasts, telling your friends, and making sure to hit subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, to help us get the word out and continue to make this content to help you study on the go.
Thank you, India. Thank you, terror. Thank you, disillusion man. Thank you, frailty. Thank you, consequence. Thank you.